enterprising in my surroundings. I'm finding the quietest of states these days. Just representation of storm brewing. Amazed that the focus remains the focal point of my change.
Hello and welcome to the Rambling Runner Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Chittum, and this is the podcast for all the dedicated amateur runners out there who are working hard to get better while balancing running with the rest of their lives. And that's exactly who I got on the show today. So I'm doing just that. Brian Schroy is here. This guy is the man. I loved talking to him. It kind of reminds me of a couple of the conversations that I've had with Peter Bromica, with his quest to OTQ. Brian comes from a very different background than that. And that is for sure, as you'll hear. Brian had a kind of a unique high school experience from a sports and just school perspective, and just a fascinating guy. What we're going to do is, I'll just say this. This is a really fun conversation, but it also, he had a great conversation with Chris Chavez on the CDS Mag pod. So once you hear this, I would suggest, if you like it, and I'm sure you will, go back and listen to that episode as well. I'll put a link in the show notes because they touch more on Brian's history than I do in this podcast, thinking that, hey, if you're interested in that feature story element, even more an in-depth perspective, you can go back, listen to that episode. It's really well done. So let's get into it with Brian Schroy. All right. I am excited to talk to Brian Schroy, who is now on the podcast. Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it is a pleasure to be here in good company.
I feel the same way. I'm looking at you. You're doing some amazing things. You just got out of a track workout. So before we dive into what you got going on and your fascinating athletic history, what was today all about?
Well, today was a bit of a surprise. I had 10 by 300 meters on the schedule, but with just a short recovery, 100-meter recovery. But I got surprised with 16 when I actually showed up. So, yeah, we're in a pretty big marathon block right now. So getting a little speed under the belt was a good shock to the system. So,
and when you're doing 16 300s, what kind of effort are you thinking about on the up-tempo side and then also on the recovery side?
You know, I have always tried to think of it like, see how we can go on those straightaways and you know, kind of relax the curve. So I just try to divide it into three and say, I run fast for this straightaway, I relax around this curve, and then I run fast for the straightaway again. And then it's, you know, you're home. So
that begs the question then. So then your coach can really mess with you depending on where they decide to start the 300s, right? Yeah. If they start it at the straightaway, then you have two hard sessions.
Totally. But you know, if I get two curves, then I feel like I get to relax a little more. But this was definitely, you know, a pretty solid effort. We started probably around 10K for the first two or three, and then pretty much jumped into mile effort from there on out. So, yeah, got some good turnover today.
And you look fresh. I mean, you finished relatively recently, but you look pretty good, man.
Yeah, I think I finished at 9. So, yeah, we're like 30 minutes out.
Oh, you're crushing it. This is really exciting. So is there... And you're training for the fall?
Yes, I am actually training for Chicago, which seems to be a popular one this year. But the thing I love about Chicago is it's actually my birthday weekend. So, you know, some people like to just have a big party. I like to go torture myself for 26 miles for my birthday.
There you go. Oh, that's exciting. So there's so many marathons this fall. Yeah. We all seen, anyone who's listened to the show knows the deal. I don't have to recant exactly what happened. Yeah. There's so many to choose from. How did you end up deciding, you know, which one to go for?
A couple of reasons. Like I said, a marathon. I didn't know Boston was going to be on the same timeline as Chicago when I signed up.
And you're a Wellesley guy. I mean, you're not born, but you were living in, you know, the halfway point of the Boston Marathon for a large part of your life.
Yeah, which is funny, and I'm sure we'll talk about it later. But you know, I went to the marathon as a kid and kind of spectated, and like never thought that I would ever be running marathons. And I just kind of was like, oh, this is cool. So like the actual training I've done on the course is so minimal compared to what you think it could be being born on the halfway point. But yeah, I mean, it's Chicago. It's a fast course. In the last kind of 2 years, I've just really gained significant amounts of fitness that I didn't really think possible. So I mean, I know we don't know what the Olympic trial standard is going to be for the next block, but I'm trying to chip away at that time. And I'm kind of looking at faster courses now and races that are really going to have fast packs to go after. So I got a development program for Chicago, which gives me a little bit of an edge. And that's one of the reasons I chose to do Chicago this fall.
There you go. Tell me about that, the American Development Program.
Yeah, so I'm actually not 100% sure the standards. I kind of think that it's around 240 marathon. But yeah, you just kind of get a nicer place to warm up. I think there's more separate bathrooms, and then you get to start a little bit in front of the crowd. And I think it's a slightly later start time, or in terms of like what time you have to be in the corral. So I think you get like 5 minutes extra sleep.
And Chicago is different, especially in terms of the male and female start. I think last time when a lot of us think about Chicago, you know, it's like, all right, well, when was that? Or the years kind of blend together over the last 18 months or so. But that I feel like there's these two iconic pictures of Chicago, at least in my mind, is Bridget just running away from all of the top women, right? And then also of American women connected to like marathon male runners at your level. And this whole group, like, and Ben Bruce, who you ran with the Valley Half Marathon, you know, kind of, pull, you know, this huge group of people, men and women, that seem to be really working together to get to that next level. Do you feel like you envision something similar to that this time around?
Definitely. I mean, I think that helping people in my races definitely like helps motivate me doing my own running. So if there's an opportunity, I'd love to work with some of the top American women or women in general and just help them achieve their goals while I'm chasing mine. So,
and you have such an interesting, like, again, you came to running later in life. And I've talked about that briefly in the intro, and we'll touch on some of that here. Also, I should say you touched on a lot of this with your podcast last year with Chris Chavez over on the Sidious Magpie. So I don't want to do a complete redo of the conversation you had there. There's going to be some of your background that I would say people go back to that podcast. You and Chris had an awesome conversation. It was absolutely fascinating. But I want to do the exact same show on just a different podcast stream, especially since Chris is already better at this than I am. If I tried to recreate it, it would just be worse. With that said, you have such a fascinating history of running with interesting people, right? So you're at the Valley Half, you know, you ran with a core group of people there. Again, like it was Ben, it was Steph, Lindsey Flanagan. It was a really interesting group there that you finished among. In addition to that, you were a pacer for the track battle of the year. Forget the Chavez versus Gladwell. You were right there. You had, I wouldn't say a front row seat. You were in front of the front row. Like you were, they were behind you. How did you get involved with that?
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of it was Chris Chavez came to visit Boulder last summer. And we just kind of became instant buds. So
just get in touch and
for work, kind of go to New York a decent amount. So, you know, I check in with those guys whenever I'm there. And I was kind of looking for an excuse to go to New York, and he was like, hey, you want to pace this mile that we're doing? And then I realized, you know, originally it was just kind of pace a mile, try to help Chris break 5 minutes. And then I found out that there was the Gladwell challenge. So, and then it even grew into like this, you know, in quotes, influencer mile. So I got to meet some super interesting people that week, but I didn't know exactly what I was signing up for, but it was super fun. I love just that New York City energy. It's so different. The running culture over there is just totally different in the sense that it's just, you know, Boulder's a very competitive community. Everyone has their clubs. And in New York, it's just all for the love. You know, everyone, you'll go to the track and there will just be hundreds of people. And I always, you know, the comparison I always make is like in Boulder, everyone's just fighting for like lane one, where in New York City, they don't care what lane they're in. They're just happy to be on the track.
Isn't it? Because you lived in New York post-college, and that's kind of what your entree into running happened in and around that time. When you look back on it now, did you have glimpses of the running culture while you were there, or were you completely divorced, not only from participating in it, but just from being aware of it?
Oh, I was totally divorced from it. I definitely, like, my only experience with running when I was living in New York City was like a quick fix for exercise before I went to the office. So if I, you know, slept in a little bit before I had my 8:30 a.m. desk job, I was like, oh, I can probably get 2 miles in before work. But that was kind of it. It was like, if I could get, you know, 20 minutes of running in before work, you know, twice a week. Otherwise, it was like, go to the gym and do my weight routine. That was pretty much my exercise program for like 3 of my 4 years in New York.
And running 2 miles in New York, like, unless you live like right next to Central Park or like right along the water on the east side or west side, like running 2 miles is like, wait, am I just going to run around my block the whole time? Or do I have to actually deal with stoplights here?
Totally. Yeah. I had two little loops. I was about half a mile from the High Line. So I would actually run to the end of the High Line and back, which is like not a super fun run. It's like all graded and you're dodging people. But it was always like a cool thing to do in the morning. And then I would make it West Side Highway and like just under a mile and just run there for like, you know, a little bit and flip and come back for another mile. So
the West Side Highway is tough. I used to travel to New York all the time for work. And like, if I was going there in the winter, I remember each time like relearning the lesson of like, this gets icy quick. And because, you know, because the sun's coming up in the east, it's like you do your morning run, you're like, oh my God, it can be a disaster zone.
Oh yeah. And I had no idea what I was doing. I just like, I remember the Olympics, the Sochi Olympics were going on and they came out with this, like, you know, they always do like their podium shoe. And I was like, oh, that podium shoe looks like it has good tread. I'm going to run all winter in that shoe. And it like, wasn't even a running shoe. And I have no idea how I didn't like, you know, destroy my body. But I was like, oh, this is the best shoe. It's specifically for winter. And it was like, yeah, standing on the podium in the winter, not running.
All right. So you mentioned, like, you mentioned the difference in the communities there between New York and Boulder and how they're vastly different. I want to talk to you so much about community here because you have experienced a wide range of athletic communities in your life, and not just communities, but things, places and people who are dedicated in a variety of different ways to reaching the utmost highest level within their sport. And I think there's not a lot of people who've experienced different types of communities that have that same, I want to be the best in the sport type feel to it. So I think the first part for you was the snowboarding community. So tell us a little bit, just your intro into snowboarding and how you entered that community, going from just say someone who was out on the mountain to someone who was in a completely different zone.
Yeah, totally. So I started off as a competitive snowboarder. I found snowboarding. My dad, for his 40th birthday, booked a weekend at Sunday River in Maine, just a little ski resort. And me and my brother fell in love with
Sunday it. River is not a little ski resort.
That's what I'm used to over here, but you're like, it is a pretty big ski resort for the East Coast.
I'm just saying, I live in Rhode Island. I lived in New England my whole life. So like, I don't even ski, and even I know Sunday River.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's east over there. But yeah, so we used to go to Sunday River, and I just kind of did weekend lessons, and eventually, you know, they were kind of like, you're getting too good for weekend lessons. So I joined a competitive group, and then we started competing on weekends. And, you know, before I knew it, it's a very small industry. You know, you end up competing at a national level and there's only like 50 kids. So you start knowing everyone, and then eventually during high school, I kind of was like, why am I spending, as we talked about a little earlier, from Wellesley, Massachusetts. So I was like, why am I spending 3 hours in a car on my Friday night, you know, in high school? So I ended up going to boarding school up at Sunday River, and which had a full on competitive snowboard program. So we were getting out of school at 10:30 in the winter and snowboarding till 4 every day, and then competing on the weekends. And it just, you very quickly learn everyone's name in the industry. And then especially like going to college, you know, everyone kind of ends up in the same places. I went to CU Boulder, looking for the bigger mountains, and immediately kind of stuck to my ski and snowboard friends, which ended up putting me kind of in the ski and snowboard industry through and after college. By that time, you know, as we talk about so often in running, I definitely had that snowboard burnout where I got to about 18 and just didn't have the love for it. You know, I enjoyed the coaching. I enjoyed the atmosphere. I enjoyed hanging with my snowboard friends. But, you know, it was easier to just not drive an hour and a half to the mountains and just hang out in Boulder than convince myself to wake up at 6 in the morning to drive. in the mountains to beat traffic.
Absolutely. And it's with those, again, I don't want to call it a niche sport because skiing and snowboarding are extremely popular worldwide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But from a elite competitive perspective, it does get niche and it gets niche fast, right?
Yeah,
totally. So, and there's a lot of other sports like that. And I feel like with those sports, and I'd love to, you correct me here if I'm wrong, it's just seeing like there is this this rage to specificity very mm-hmm. early on and to really be like, all right, if you're 16, you're 15, if you want to get to the Olympics, this is the roadmap. There is no like, I'm going to do this sport, right? I'm going to play mm-hmm. football and basketball. And then in college, maybe I'll decide. Can you talk about the pressure there, whether it's firm or just the inherent pressure of doing that sort of thing at an early age?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that you kind of have a couple paths you can choose. There's obviously the racing side, and then there's the freestyle side. And then in the freestyle side, it's kind of, you know, you figure out whether you like the half pipe or slopestyle, which is the jumps, or you try to balance both. And then it even gets, you know, smaller when you get into the professional, whether you want to be a competitive snowboarder or a film snowboarder. So you kind of figure out early what you want to be doing, what your love is. And I kind of stuck to the more freestyle realm. But yeah, there's definitely like that divide. Like, you know, I don't know any snowboarders who are into the racing scene, even though it's a small world. But all my roots were kind of in the freestyle scene. So you kind of choose your discipline and then you get paired with a coach because your racing coach is not going to be the same as your freestyle coach. But it's definitely, you know, learning that competitive way of thinking mentality from a young age, because a lot of these people are trying to make the Olympics and it is a very young sport. You know, most of these pro snowboarders are somewhere between 16 and 22 years old right now. So, it's kind of crazy to think that a lot of people that were competing in high school that were my age were, you know, pursuing stuff like the X Games and Olympics.
Yeah. And when you're talking about that age group, did you find, generally speaking, that the coaches and advisors for the athletes were kind of pushing them to be more competitive, or did they have to kind of rein you in from hyper competition in those types of settings?
You know, I think the ski and snowboard industry, definitely the snowboard industry, is kind of, it's very competitive, but it's also very lax. So I think that coaches kind of want to keep you at your comfort zone. And it's more just like training was kind of like, okay, we're going to go to the third
ever, and we're just going to hit this for an afternoon.
And it would be like, we're going to get comfortable. And the more we do this, the more your tricks might progress and you'll feel more confident. So I think it was kind of like a go at your own pace sport. But, you know, to be able to commit to something 7 days a week and then competing on the weekends, it just does take a competitive mindset, no matter how you slice it.
Within that context, did most of the people have similar goals within the sport itself?
I think yes and no. I mean, we all were competitive, but for me, I always loved, you know, the social aspect and like being out there, you know, chairlift. I love the chairlift. Like that's where you have the best conversations. It's like the long run of snowboarding is just sitting with your buds on a chairlift and just talking about nothing. So I definitely loved it for the people and it was fun. You know, I look back at my memories in snowboarding and I was like, wow, that was a ton of fun. But I never really saw it as like a career or something that I was pursuing necessarily at the highest level. I was, you know, seeing where I could get in the sport, ever think that like the X Games or Olympics were in my cards.
That's interesting, you know, that you were in that group of like, all right, I'm going to a specialized school for this endeavor, but I don't necessarily see myself pursuing this as a professional. Would you view yourself as within that, again, I know it's a small school, the majority of people would fall into your camp or more towards the, all right, I'm here to be elite and to be a professional and this to be a part of my career path?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was kind of divided. You know, I think that some people who went to the school just, you know, it was a good school in Maine. And a lot of people, like, especially in Maine, there's like all these little islands. So kids will be like, instead of going to school with 13 classmates, I can go to school with 70 classmates. And they'd come over and they wouldn't really be involved in the skiing and snowboarding. It would just be kind of an extracurricular for them. And then there were some people who were like, I am absolutely going to this school to pursue, you know, the highest caliber of skiing or snowboarding. We definitely had a very serious ski racing program. So I'd say ski racing was definitely like the most serious of the disciplines. And then you had a lot of people, you know, at our school, we also were required to do two sports. So some people were just like, yeah, I'd love to snowboard and something else.
There you go. All right. So with the social element being the higher priority, not the only priority, because obviously you loved it and you went up there for this. What do you think, looking back now, with hindsight being 2020 or whatever, that you can say what led to you actually still burning out on the sport, even though you weren't necessarily someone who was like, you know, go hard or go home. This is the only thing that I need in my life.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing was just that you're still putting in the work. I mean, you're still doing it 7 days a week. You know, you're in freezing cold conditions. There's nothing worse than, I think there was one slopestyle contest that was actually at Sunday River, and it was like negative 18 degrees without wind chill. And we were just like, why are we here? Why are we doing this? And, you know, there's nothing less motivating for, you know, throwing your body off like a 50-foot jump than negative 18 degrees and just landing on ice. So it was a lot of that. I mean, some days it's just harder than others to get out there, especially, you know, we joke that it's the ice coast. So we don't have these nice slushy takeoffs or landings. Sometimes it's just very firm and unmotivating to huck your body off these elements.
Well, especially if you're going over to Wildcat Mountain, which I think is ice all the time, all year round.
Oh yeah. Wildcat. Yeah.
All right. So tell me about just like the, again, going back to the community side of being in a situation where it's a very small community, right? And it's also potentially zero sum, right? You have like, there's only so many spots for Olympics, there's only so many spots for sponsors. The sport itself is a judging sport. So it's not like, hey, this was my time at this race. This is like, no, this is how I was judged with whatever tricks I was doing. How were you and the people who did it well within your community able to balance the zero sum nature of parts of the sport with the idea of like, hey, I'm also here to enjoy the people around me. And that can be sometimes push and pull.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that was always a struggle for me, was the fact that there are judges and you can feel like you have the best performance of your life and the judges can think otherwise. So that was always tough. But, you know, one of the beautiful moments in those freezing cold, unmotivating days is you're all in it together. And you're all kind of in these like corrals at the top of the course, hanging out and psyching each other up. And, you know, you're listening to your friends like headphone with one ear and just kind of rocking out and getting to know your friends. So there was a lot of that, like, okay, for the 30 seconds of my run, I'm going to be all in this. But at the beginning, I'm going to be sitting there with my friends, like getting pumped up. And when I finish my run, I'm going to be hugging my friend at the bottom. So it's definitely all of in between the start and the finish. I still think that just sharing those tough experiences with competitors makes it all worthwhile. Like if you watch any X Games, you'll see everyone just hugging at the bottom, and they're still doing it. You know, they've made their own communities from this international tour, and they love seeing someone one up them or do something they've never seen before or land a trick they've been trying for months. So that is the beauty of the sport. But also some days you might land a trick you've been trying for months and the judges can be like, well, that wasn't that cool.
It also reminds me a lot of trail running. Because you see the elite trail runners seem to have a very similar mindset of like, hey, I'm trying to rock it here. But at the same time, if you do awesome, I'm going to cheer you on. And again, there can still be that push and pull of like, all right, there maybe there's not like jealousy in a negative way, but like, wow, I wish I had the kind of performance that person just had. But it does seem to be a more of, hey, we're in this to kind of lift each other up type moments. Yeah. And when it's time to go, obviously I want to do my best, but I'm not trying to pull anyone else down in order to get to the top.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, you are all friends and I think I take that into running too. When I'm running, I'm always just focused on what I'm doing. And I was kind of doing that in snowboarding, and either it would work out or it wouldn't, but it's always on my own performance. And that's what I like about running, is I'm always trying to beat myself. And if I lose to a friend, awesome. They had a great day. If, you know, they come in behind me, you know, it is what it is, but I just care about my own time and lifting up those around me. And I hope that everyone else is actually having a better day than me.
There you go. We'll see. And we'll talk about your kind of early adopter status in running, which is fascinating because there's so many people who listen to this show who came to running a little later in life. And while you were a high level and competitive athlete as a youngster, you know, it's also a very different sport. It's not like someone coming from, again, like say like soccer or Nordic skiing into running, where it's like, wow, there's a ton of crossover here. You came from a very different kind of sport. And obviously there's some crossover when you're athletic, especially you're doing stuff with your legs. There's stuff there, but it's not exactly the same. So talk to me about your progress from an early adopter standpoint in running, because you got to check some things off your list, especially as a marathoner, very quickly. Compared to maybe a lot of other people who've taken up the sport.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it is funny to think that I went from a sport where my legs were actually like strapped in and I couldn't move them to a sport where I have to be possible. I mean, I didn't really do a whole lot of running growing up. We would occasionally have it as cross training. I did play lacrosse when I was at that boarding school. We were kind of like the bad news bears. So we would have a lot of 0-7 records or whatever against the three preps. But it was always fun. But I hated running. I know a lot of people do. So if we had to do like the 2-mile hilly course for conditioning, I definitely never mind it. But yeah, with snowboarding, especially the social aspect, it's not as serious as the running culture of, you know, people let themselves go and party pretty hard. And especially as someone who wasn't competing, I was kind of only there for the partying. So I went to University of Colorado history. I just started snowboarding a lot less and partying a lot more. I think it's one of the few sports that you can kind of still get away with that. I think, you know, it is an Olympic sport, and you know, X Games and this competitive circuit are a little more serious. You do see guys weight room more. That wasn't necessarily the case when I was doing it. It was more just like show up and hopefully you land your run. So I was definitely into the social scene of the snowboard and ski world, and not so much into the actual activity. Needless to say, I gained about 50 something pounds in college from where I am now. I mean, it was a long process from like high school to end of college of, you know, competitive beer drinking. But yeah, I graduated college around 205 pounds, moved to New York, wanted to get somewhat healthy, you know, back to fighting shape a bit. So lost like 15 to 20 pounds, just like including a little bit of running and strength training and trying to, you know, practice a better diet. But then in New York City, that's kind of impossible. So I spent 3 years in New York working in the snowboard industry. I was doing public relations for a firm out there that was specializing in action sports. And then I kind of decided with my own connections in the ski and snowboard industry to break off and do my own thing. And then somewhere around year 4 in New York, I moved back to Boulder. And that's when I kind of realized like, oh, I can, you know, change what's on my plate and I don't have to eat out. And I actually have a kitchen that's full size. So I started trying to eat a little better, but I also, towards the end of my, stint in New York, found boxing and, got really into boxing. So that was my new competitive edge. And that got pretty quick. Not so much with the weight loss, but just like the endurance, feeling that, you know, heart rate beating out of its chest again, and those endorphins. So I got really into boxing. And then when I moved back to Boulder, I decided to sign up for my first fight. Not really realizing I had a lingering shoulder injury from snowboarding. So second punch of my first fight, I tore my shoulder right out of the socket. And that was pretty much it for my boxing career. But
I'm wincing right now. I've seen someone do that on a softball field, take a hard swing and like their shoulders like, see you later. God, it is painful to witness.
Oh, it is a terrible feeling. It was awful. But I immediately got surgery. And then kind of in that same time frame, I met a runner who is now my wife. And she was training for the Boston Marathon. And kind of the first thing I could do in the rehab process with my shoulder was run. So I just kind of, you know, had this fitness addiction now because of all the boxing. And I was just looking for something to, you know, keep my activity level high. And I asked her if I could start joining her on some training runs. And before I knew it, I had essentially done an entire marathon training block for Boston. And that's where I found running.
That is awesome. And you went quickly from, again, you were in 318 at Chicago, and you again, well, a lot of this you cover with Chris Chavez. So yeah, I'm going to say like people should really listen to that episode. It's awesome. So we're going to skip over some of this stuff. So yeah, 318 in New York, I'm sorry, 318 New York. And then after that, like you broke three, the next marathon. I mean, you quickly went from, all right, 318, but you were like, it wasn't like a full 318. You're helping a friend in the first pro, yeah, in the beginning. Who knows? Maybe that was a benefit. Maybe like you would have done a horrible positive split if you didn't help your friend in the beginning. But and then after that, break three, qualify for Boston. Mm-hmm. Like here we are, this early adopter, you know, taking off very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And when you were going, now looking back on that, when you think about what were some of the reasons why you were able to kind of really knock some of these times off pretty quickly. Can you think of them, whether they're physical, mental, dietary? What were some reasons you think you were able to knock some of these out fairly quickly?
Totally. I mean, I think that the boxing conditioning definitely helped, because the kind of crazy thing was I was still really into boxing when I decided to sign up for New York. So I did the training block with my wife for Boston, but she was only really running like 3 or 4 days a week. We didn't have a coach. We weren't doing workouts. It was just do a long run on the weekend, add a mile each week until you get to like 21 and then taper. So I started, that was, you know, my first plan. And then going into, I think I did Vancouver after New York because it looked pretty. I didn't know anything about the course. And I decided, you know, I was going to just box for 3 days a week and run 3 days a week and take a rest day. Still no workouts. The first marathon I did, it was like bucket list item with a friend. We were just like, let's do this. And he didn't train and I did. So as mentioned, he was fading pretty quickly around mile eight. And I eventually was like, you know, I trained for this, I'm going for it. So hit 318 and kind of always wondered like, could I qualify for Boston? Could I have just run a little faster on that first marathon? So I just immediately signed up for something. And I qualified in Vancouver at my next marathon. I think a lot of it was, you know, growing up with that discipline of just, you know, commitment to training. I think that I did have a little bit of extra conditioning, from getting really into boxing. And I just don't think I ever hated running. I really loved running as soon as I started doing it. I did do the Boulder 10K for fun with the same friend who we decided to do New York together with. That was kind of my first like race, and we totally did it as a fun run. I have no idea what the time was, and I was still like 20 pounds heavier at that point. We did that, and I kind of finished that run and was like, wow, 6.2 miles didn't seem that bad. Like I could run 6 miles more frequently. And I tried kind of from there on to incorporate these slightly longer runs, go from the 2 mile of just getting fitness when I could to like, maybe I can, you know, reserve an hour a couple times a week and get some running in. And I think that right into Chicago in 2017 is when I kind of decided I want to get a coach and learn how to actually do this. And that's kind of when the rest was history.
All right. Well, let's talk about that moment, because it's one thing for someone to say like, all right, I'm doing this and now I want to get a coach, right? For a lot of people, it's pre like qualifying for Boston, right? Usually the getting the coach part comes like that helps them get there, right? Yeah. Because they're for whatever reason. So you're all of a sudden, you're like, no, I've already run in the 240s. I'm doing some interesting things. But at the same time, you're doing it in the place that's like, you know, running Central USA, especially for endurance running, you're doing it in Boulder. So what's it like as someone who's running in the 240-ish for the marathon, which like I live in Rhode Island. If you're a 240 marathon living in Rhode Island, you're one of the best runners around, like period, full stop. You're doing it in a place where if you're running the 240s and you're a women's runner, you're like, oh yeah, there's another person, right? To say nothing of a male endurance runner. Mm-hmm. So what was that like? Knowing what you know now, not only the running community, but the differences in different areas of the country.
Well, it's actually so funny because, you know, I, as I mentioned, went to school here and didn't do any running. And I just like, I knew that world existed, but like, it was just so. So when I started running, you know, we had these great bike trail systems in Boulder, and I would do everything on these bike paths. And I thought that was it. I was like, this is the running mecca. The Boulder Creek Path. Little did I know that we have like miles and miles and miles of farm roads that are just like perfect dirt rolling hills. That is actually what attracts people to Boulder. So I was doing all these like 20 mile runs on this, you know, exposed windy creek path. And then Erin, my wife, moved out and she was like, wow, you know, these creek paths are great. And then finally, when we found a coach and started doing some of these group runs, we discovered like all the farm roads and we were like, are you kidding? This has been here the whole time, like 15 minutes away. We had no idea. And that's when we kind of, you know, fully understood how spoiled we were to be in Boulder. But I think, you know, we were running on the sidewalk a lot like everyone else. So in the beginning, we had no idea how spoiled we were. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing about Boulder. It's such a unique place where it's, you know, these beautiful rolling dirt routes, and you just have, you know, hundreds of people out on the weekends. You know, you drive to the parking lot and just it's full. And what makes it so unique is, you know, a lot of my friendships are built at 7 a.m. when people decide to come run, and, you know, instead of maybe like doing lunch, it's like, let's go for a run. So I think that's a very unique thing about the culture, is like, there's so many other people doing it with you that, you know, you can always find someone who's, oh, hey, it's 3 o'clock. Why don't we go for a jog?
And you were able to experience what going all in means as a teenager. You saw people going all in,
yeah,
right? For skiing and snowboarding. Mm-hmm. And you are now in Boulder seeing people go all in, not only for, you know, doing the marathon, you're seeing obviously a lot of trail runners, you're seeing other sports as well. Boulder's not just a running community, as you witnessed in college. Like you weren't even aware of the running community in college, and you were able to witness high level athletes all the time. So knowing the kind of the full panoply of options that you've seen, as well as seeing from different perspectives, what does going all in mean for you, knowing what you know about elite athletes and what they're able to do?
Yeah, well, I ran Boston in 2018, and that was the terrible rainy year with the really bad headwinds, and I don't think anyone had a good day. And that year I was like, started working with a coach that was kind of in between Chicago and Boston. I started working with that coach. It was right before Chicago, but I don't really think I, you know, got much out of a month of training before Chicago. But yeah, I ran 244 in Boston in like the worst of days. And that's when my coach pulled me aside and he was like, you need to go all in. And I was like, what? I was really enjoying like my 3 days of running and boxing and my rest day.
Look, all the improvement I've done. What do you mean?
Yeah, go all in. And that was kind of that crossroads of us. where I was like, I really should pick a sport. And I still box, you know, I still do it during my downtime. Like anytime I take a rest week or whatever, I'll go, you know, to the boxing gym.
And we should say you work in that industry on some level, right? Yeah. You're not. So this is a major part of your life, not just simply as an athlete.
Yeah, totally. So I transitioned to kind of 5 days of running to 7 days of running to 7 days of running with doubles. And now it's kind of been this like 90 mile week to 100 mile week progression. And that's, you know, I didn't want to admit it. I was like, oh yeah, I can just get by with boxing and running a bit. But I ran 244 in Boston and then I ran 230 at CIM like 6 months later. And I was like, okay, running a lot helps. And having a coach.
And absolutely. And running in an area where you know, you're getting pushed, obviously. Yeah. And then you can talk about this too. You know, you're part of something now that is all about embracing the recovery side of things.
Yeah.
But part of that is because you want to push it on days where we're pushing it, and running with runners who are better than you, even just slightly better than you, can really help. So how did you align yourself with people who obviously you are a fan of and you like spending time with, but also that were a good match for you as a runner? Because first of all, there's so many runners around. And as you mentioned before, you were kind of ignorant to like, what's going on around here? Like, I don't even know where I should be running, never mind who to run with.
Totally. Well, yeah, it was funny. I joined Boulder Track Club as my first team. And the way my wife's schedule was at the time, we could kind of only do the afternoon group, and there wasn't really anyone in the afternoon group. So I was doing most of my workouts alone or with my coach at the time, because he was also training for a marathon. But he would pick and choose if he wanted to coach or actually work out, depending on like what he ate that day, kind of. So sometimes I had him, sometimes I didn't. But we all had these great long runs, and that's where I kind of discovered the beauty of Boulder running was doing like the full team long runs on Sundays. And that's where, you know, someone would always try to be a hero and push the pace. And, you know, it was kind of survival of the fittest. But then I wanted something a little more structured. So I decided to join like a slightly more competitive group after CIM, which I ran in 2018. So yeah, from 2018, I switched to a different group. And that's where I kind of found all my running friends today. And I did kind of find that perfect balance of having one or two people faster than me that I could always chase, or having a couple of people that could work with me, or if I wasn't having such a good day that I could, you know, back off a little bit. And, you know, there's something beautiful about being right in the middle. So yeah, we running together now for about 2 years, and just having people to push you and having, you know, a coach that pays attention to you and is really helping you seek those goals and just believes in you. I think that's the biggest thing, finding someone who just believes in you, has made such a difference. And I haven't really had a chance to race in 2 years for the marathon, but, you know, I'm a different runner than I was 2 years ago. So I'm very excited to get back on the start line. And now that I've been in like 2 years of training at a very high level with a very high level group, seeing where that leads.
Yeah, that is really exciting. That is for sure. And I want to talk to you about like what happened kind of before everything shut down, because you were at the point where you were improving rapidly.
Yeah.
Things were going really well. And it seemed like every time you were out there, you were getting a PR of some sort, which is super exciting. And also kind of what a lot of people get that same sort of feedback when they're trying something fairly new. Right. It's easy to make big gains early on because, well, you're new. Right. So anything that you're doing is going to lead to improvement. And then here we go. And then, you know, the rate at which those gains can come starts to, you know, slow down a lot once you gain certain experience and as you improve and consistently improve. Right. So once you got to the point where, you know, your PRs are going from minutes to seconds. And, you know, you're kind of like in that 230 zone and really fighting and clawing for every second kind of PR. What was it like for you when the speed of progress changed? Like, did it affect you physically and mentally once you got to that point?
Yeah, it was super tough for me, especially because it is funny. I've run my last three races in the 230s and or at 230 and change. But I've PR'd in every one. So I ran like 230, 34 through 230, 22, 230, 14 or something like that.
Right. Yeah. It's like the equivalent of like a really good, like pick up a water stop. Yeah. Like that could be like the difference between a PR or not, like at that time.
Yeah, totally. But you know, the circumstances were all very different. So that CIM, the one where I first ran 230, was an incredible breakthrough for me. But the other two, you know, they were still PR. So you got to be happy with that.
Oh, but, absolutely.
Yeah. But I felt like training was going great for the London Marathon, which was the next race. And then I got pneumonia like a month before, so I couldn't run for a month. And I also had a charity bib. So I got to the start line super, super early. And I was like, I'm just going to be in the front of my wave and just like go for it. And then they released another corral in front of my wave. So I thought I was in this prime positioning. All of a sudden, hundreds of people are in front of me. So I ended up like having to zigzag for the first 4 miles. And then you meet the rest of the field in mile four. So I was pretty much zigzagging around people till mile nine. It finally like cleared out. And I got like the marathon alert that I had run like 2:28 and still had like half a mile to go because of all the weaving. So like those were just bad circumstances. And I mean, I was so happy with that result coming out of pneumonia, but I was like,
if I was
in like the right field, what would have happened? And then going into my next CIM, I thought I was really fit and ready to run somewhere in the 225s. And it was like,
really, and this was like the OTQ CIM, yeah, right? This was the one that everyone was like, oh, this is OTQville, men and women, the whole group is going for it.
Yeah. And what was super interesting, that was 2019, is that it was incredibly humid, but it was also cool. It was like 50 degrees. So no one realized how they were overheating or just getting dehydrated. So every single one of my friends in Boulder had a very, very tough day. I just, you know, Boulder's a dry place. So none of us like realized how the humidity was affecting us. So yeah, I got really sick at mile 20 and I went to pull out. I was like, I took a bad gel. I felt awful. I started puking. I walked to a medical tent and then my wife was trying to OTQ herself. And I said to myself, what if I miss this? What happens if I don't make it to the finish line? So I kept running and somehow I still snuck in at 30. But you know, I definitely thought I was going to run that one like 5 minutes faster. So this is like the redemption tour now where I finally everything's in line. I had a great block of training going into Boston 2020. I ran the entire Boston, or I ran 24 miles of the Boston course. I had a 10-mile tempo at marathon pace, which I pretty much did into my office. My office, I work remotely, but my office is based in Boston. So I showered, got to my office, turned on the TV, and they had canceled the marathon. So I had the best workout of my life, only to turn on the TV and find out it was canceled. And I didn't need to do any of that. And that's where we've been ever since. It's like kind of signing up for stuff that getting canceled and just trying to stay consistent. And I know that you can't be marathon training forever. So, you know, I was focusing on shorter distance stuff for a bit. I did sneak in a half marathon in Nebraska. I'm in the best training block of my life and I'm just excited for Chicago.
And are there certain things that you're focusing on as a marathon? I know we all have things that come more naturally to us and things that maybe we have to work harder to maximize as a marathon. Are there certain things that you feel like you need to improve on in order to maybe reach the potential that you've been, you know, getting so close to potentially reaching?
Yeah. I mean, I am definitely trying to qualify for the Olympic trials in the marathon. That's the goal for the not so distant future. They haven't released the time, so we just don't know what that looks like. But I'm trying to do a realistic approach of, you know, yes, my last three marathons have been 230, so I don't expect to just run 218 my next go around. But if I can just chip away at that, kind of, I had a lot of time to get faster and focus on just getting that turnover that I need. But I still think that I can improve on that. And I've had great time to sharpen my endurance as well. So I'm just trying to, you know, put a big PR on my resume in the next go around and then chip away from that. And, you know, as you were just saying, PRs get smaller and smaller the faster you get. So if I can get somewhere in the low 220s in my next go around, then, you know, even lower the next time and all of a sudden it's, you know, 219, then we have, you know, the recipe for an OTQ.
There you go. And I know there's a bit of consternation with folks and even coaches who specifically for the athletes who are kind of like on the potential borderline of an OTQ, both men and women, and how if you go back 5 years, you know, when did they announce, you know, this is like the mindset that's going on. Like, when did they announce the window and there's no announcement yet? And there's kind of this hand wringing of like, when are they going to make this announcement? You know, I think a lot that we've seen over the last 18 months is kind of like how you view certain things, yeah, and how you approach it. How have you been able to work through this kind of like up in the air nature of the qualifying process under the guise of like, hey, like there's only so much you can control anyway?
Well, I actually kind of think it's nice. You know, I have some friends who won't run a marathon until they know the standard, which kind of makes sense. But I just like knowing that the pressure's off for a little bit. I think that if I knew exactly what the Olympic trial standard was right now, then maybe there'd be a little more pressure to just go for it in Chicago. But with right now, you know, my expectation is just to have the best race that I can have and build off that. So I think, you know, as I said earlier, I just care about my own performance and being able to build on that. So I do think that with a lot of this unknown, it's just how can I improve from the last time I ran a marathon and being happy to know that I can run a marathon.
Right. Do you feel like you need to know the time in order to like reach that time? Like, let me put it this way. Say it's 216, yeah, right? Do you need to know that it's 216 in order to get there? Or can you just be like, hey, I'm going to run my best, I'm going to train hard, and we'll make it happen? Like, do you feel like you need that carrot?
I think it definitely, you know, changed the goal. It would definitely move the needle. But I think that a lot of it is putting yourself to succeed. Like I am strategic now of what marathons I sign up for, because maybe New York is going to be 4 minutes slow or 5 minutes, or, you know, that I won't have a fast pack that I can kind of tuck in with. I think you get to a point where it's kind of like you need to put yourself in the situation to reach that goal. So I think that on a perfect day, regardless of time, you might just be able to tuck in and have the race of your life. And that's something that I think about all the time. Like, okay, if the weather's perfect and, you know, I'm just, everything's connecting, maybe the time doesn't matter and I'll just have that day. But it's also, you know, I have to be realistic of my fitness, and there's nothing worse than just going out too hot in a marathon and suffering for the second half. So I try to like keep my goals realistic and have something to base it on. And, you know, we were talking about it earlier, but my current roommate works for Stride. And so I run with one of those Stride pods on my foot for like all my workouts. And they have a pretty interesting race predictor. And I've started using power a lot more than pace. So as long as I can hold certain goal powers, then the time doesn't matter to me. Cause I just know that's kind of my current fitness. So that's kind of how I've approached this last training block, is really focus on like essentially the effort and the wattage I'm putting out. Because I know that I can't really cheat that. I could maybe run a little faster, but if I'm running in the red the whole time, it's just not going to work out. It's going to be a tough last 6 miles.
Well, we'll definitely be rooting for you, Brian. That is for sure. And I'm so excited for you. Last thing before we get going, though, you spent a lot of time in the mountains. You grew up in the mountains.
Yeah.
You now live in the mountains.
Yeah.
So I have to ask, what has kept you more of a road racer as opposed to a trail runner? And is there going to be any point where there's maybe, you know, both of them will combine, or you see yourself trying new things? Again, I'm someone who is mostly road too. I am expanding a little bit recently, but it's just interesting to me that you gravitated more towards the roads considering your background.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have a ton of fun running trails. I think there's definitely a time and place for it. I really enjoy it. But I think kind of as with the success I've seen in the marathon, I just want to see where it's going to take me. And with the running community in Boulder and these great teammates, you know, that's where we find most of our conversations, is out on the road. So you kind of feel like you're running on the road with these long dirt, or the trails with these long dirt roads. I just kind of want to see where I can get in the road element of the sport before I transition. But I know that trail running will be in my future.
There you go. This is exciting. Like you said, you run on trails all the time. It's more of like, where are you racing, as opposed to, you know, where are you running day to day? Brian, thank you so much for coming on. This was a blast. And I'd love to have you back on again. For the same reason, we'd love to catch up with Peter Bromka and a variety of other people who are, you know, going hard after long-term goals and doing it in a fun and exciting way. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Of course. Thank you so much. And I actually got to meet Peter Bromka. He was here 2 weeks ago. So now I'm a friend of the pod over here.
Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was an absolute blast. Such a great experience. Good luck to you at Chicago. We'll definitely be rooting for you and even past that. So we'll see how it goes. I know so many of you are excited about fall marathons, and I am as well. I'm going to be doing the Richmond Half and then CIM after that, hoping to do some live shows at both those events. So if you're going to those, let me know. Hopefully we can meet up and do something fun. Thank you so much for listening. And happy running. This has been a production of Rambling Runner Podcast. This podcast is produced by David Margetti of In Post Media. Thank you to Meta P for the music. His song, Righteous Path, featuring Rex Mayhem and Chip Fu, is produced by Symphonic Bang.
Yeah. Enterprising in my surroundings, I'm finding the quietest estates these days. Just representation of storm brewing, amazed that the focus remains the vocal focal point of my change. I'm trying to show this industry I got.